1982 is when I got that set. It was a little bit later than a lot of other people. The next Basic set was actually already out, but I didn't know that at the time. And my parents got me the Holmes Basic set. And, you know, I moved on to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons within a year or so. But I always remembered that Basic set very fondly, especially the sample dungeon, the one set beneath the ruined Tower of Xenopus at the in the back of the rule book. So about 10 years or so, I learned about the Maze of Peril, which Chris is going to read a sample from. And I read that, and I noticed some similarities between that and the sample dungeon. And it just got me interested in Holmes' writings, and I went back to the Basic set, and I got interested in that again. And then that led me to, I wrote a review of Maze of Peril because I thought it was underappreciated, and I posted that on a Dragon's Foot forum. And that was sort of the first thing I wrote that got me started doing the blog several years later. Now I'm here.
And Zach's blog is awesome. So it's xenopusarchives.blogspot.com.
Yes. Yeah, okay. That's right.
So that's well worth time to check out and read about. And he has a long, detailed view into the actual manuscript that was behind the Holmes rules as well in there,
luckily his Dr. Holmes preserved copies of the manuscript. And a few years ago, I was lucky enough to get a scan of the manuscript, and I was able to go through and look at it and see exactly what he had sent to TSR and what, and then how Gary Gygax edited that into the actual published format. When his father edited it originally, it was the original Dungeons & Dragons rules was all he had access to, and he just took that and edited it into the manuscript. And all the references in the published rule book that are to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons all originally were just to the original Dungeons & Dragons, and Gygax just went through and changed them to Advanced. And he also added some new rules and clarifications to the original rules, but he hadn't finished writing Advanced Dungeons & Dragons yet, so there wasn't a cohesive plan to integrate the Basic set rules with Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. So there are definitely differences between the two. So it actually is, in some ways, it's a better introduction to original Dungeons & Dragons than to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
So my name's Alan Groey. I, like Zach, I started out with the Holmes Basic set in 77. I didn't actually own a copy of it till some years later when our school librarian gave me the library copy.
Because you were using it more than anybody else.
Exactly. I was the only one who had checked it out probably at the time. she was also our gifted teacher, and I conned her into letting me do 3 term papers on D&D stuff. I wrote 2 adventures and a comparison between Balrogs as heritage miniatures and and in Lord of the Rings and in D&D.
Where did you go to school?
it was a really fun little town in South Jersey. So Eric's version of the rules was my introduction to D&D. The very first issue of Dragon Magazine I bought 2 at the same time, issue 63 and, more importantly, issue 58. And that had a copy of the In the Bag story in it. So that was along with my, sort of first period of purchasing rules and modules on my own out of newspaper money and things like that. I got this issue of Dragon that had In the Bag, and I thought it was one of the coolest fantasy stories I had read yet at that time. So it always stuck with me. And then in a few, maybe like 5 or 6 years later or so, when they published a review of Maze of Peril and Dragon, I then ordered the book, and it's still got my sticker on the side that says from when I ordered it, Groey, 6/30/87 from my bookstore in town. So that
you can
led
still
me to
purchase that original version online.
Yeah, from the
original publisher.
That's right. So Space and Time is still around, which is actually how I got in touch with Eric. I wrote to the publisher, and I said, I've got some questions about Boinger and Xerath. Can you put me in touch with John Eric Holmes? And he said, well, sure. And he gave me his address, and I wrote him a letter to the home in Oregon. And Eric very graciously wrote back to me, and he was very pleased to have somebody write and tell him how cool they thought Boinger and Xerath were.
And surprised.
and he sent me a couple copies of some of the very early stories that were published in Alarms and Excursions that I hadn't know existed at the time. And that was really what started my interest in Eric's writings with The Maze of Perils. So after we had heard that Eric had passed away and then confirmed that with his wife, I got in touch with Chris through her, and that's what led to us starting to work on pulling together the Tales of Peril compilation for all of Eric's fiction. So that's a little bit longer-winded than I intended it to be.
It's very nice.
So would you like to do the reading from the book?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, awesome. Yeah.
So the good news is I sound a lot like my dad, and so if he was here, he probably would read something similar, and it would sound very similar to what you're going to hear. The bad news is I never heard him read any of his D&D fiction, so I don't really know quite how he would pitch the voices or whatnot. And of course, I have a lovely low bass voice, so Boinger's going to sound a little too low. I think he's probably a tenor. But Xerath should sound good, because he's probably bass like me. Not that he's my favorite. I love them both. And you're also going to hear maybe a couple words from Murray the Mage, who my friend Eric Fraser created. And his major character trait is greed, and he also has a deal of cowardice and self-righteousness. Boinger's a romantic and always wants to do the right thing and gets carried away. And he has a bit of greed in his soul as well, as does Xerath, who's a cool guy. The dark elf. He tries to always be in control, and never loses cool, and never screw up, and take care of everyone. But occasionally he screws up as well. They all do, because they're D&D characters, really. They're not superheroes, and they're not even as able as Fafhrd and the Grey Mauser. They're just D&D characters, and they're low level, so. Let's hear what kind of trouble they're getting into.
So we should clarify real quickly that Xerath is a dark elf, but that doesn't mean a drow.
Yeah, I didn't actually know what dark elf meant when my dad first wrote Trell's Head, but I thought maybe it had something to do with his character or his hair color, which was fine with me. So we really can't clarify in a way, Alan.
I think
it's, if you want him to be dark elf drow, you can make him drow. You can...
Because when you originally created Xerath, the drow hadn't even been published yet.
Right.
In the monster manual.
Right, and I hadn't even read the Silmarillion. I tried reading it, but I gave up. Dad probably read it, but I don't think he was influenced by it.
Maybe you should talk about how these characters go back to your first Dungeons & Dragons game.
So, yeah, my first Dungeons & Dragons game was in the 76, perhaps. Anyway, so I was a teenager. And my older brother was in high school. I was in junior high. And he played a game with his alternative school friends. And he knew that Dad and I would love it. So he took us to a game. And we had to create three first-level characters in our first game because they thought that at least two of them would get killed off. So none of them got killed off, actually. And we wasted a lot of time rolling up three characters. And it's very difficult to play three characters as a beginning player, and I don't recommend that you introduce people to the game the way I was introduced to it. But there was enough genius in the game, even with that kind of confusion, that Dad and I fell in love with it immediately. And my homely old Sligon thief never really made it to prosperity. But Boinger and Xerath made the cut, I guess. And they started to appear in these Alarms and Excursions stories, which I was horrified to find out Dad had to Xerox himself to send to Lee Gold to staple together. And I was like, well, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. I mean, fan fiction's pretty silly on its own, but gee, yeah. Printing your own. There's one.
And they would look like this. You know, there'd be text with the illustration through it. So this illustration shows a witch doctor-looking person and a dinosaur having its head comically lopped off with little hand bones, dog bones, kind of sticking up there.
And that's from the unpublished Boinger and Xerath story, correct? That's going to be in the compilation.
That's from
Yes and
Adventures
No.
in the Lost City.
Oh, actually, yes. I've never seen that picture before.
We'll get to that question later. Let's leave the witch doctor in the reading.
That story has a witch doctor in it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see, where were we? We were at Alarms and Excursions. Okay, later I was to find out that somebody named H.P. Lovecraft was also involved in amateur fiction, so I thought, well, you know, maybe there's something to this amateur fiction anyway. When my dad showed me Troll's Head, his first story for the Dragon, I was amazed at how good it was, and I was amazed at how much better Boinger and Zerith were when my dad wrote them than when I played them. So, although I'm very proud of creating them, they weren't that great to play with. They were overly armored and a little overly concerned with safety and wealth, and they're not quite the characters he made them to become, but I still got the joy of giving them their silly names. So Boinger Zerith, Murray the Mage, a hired man named Olaf, who doesn't really have any personality, and Bardan the Dwarf, who is a brave and hopefully a dwarf with a great future ahead of him, are in a dungeon running away from a purple worm and encountered some orcs. And let's just jump in here. An orc lay dead with one of Zerith's black arrows sticking up its chest. The two human warriors were battering another orc to the ground with their long swords. Bardan the dwarf bent over the fourth, his war axe poised. Whoomp! The axe fell, and the miserable orc's head went rolling across the stone floor. Zerith took charge. All of you stay on guard. Olaf, search the bodies. Pick up the arrows. Bardan, watch the pit at the far end of the tunnel. Anybody hurt? Boinger, you all right? Yes, gasped the halfling. I'm all right. Good. Murray, should we hide the bodies? What do you think? The mage shook his head. Can't see that it'll make much difference. These handsome fellows are probably due to check in somewhere soon. When that fails to happen and they're missed, there'll be a search party out looking for them. I think we should move ahead as quickly as possible. What about these doors? Asked Boinger. Good thought. You check out one. Bardan the other. The little halfling listened to the wood panel. Nothing. He gently tried the latch, but the door was locked. The dwarf and the fighting men gathered in front of the other door, and with a few kicks and thumps got it open. Olaf, holding a torch in his left hand, cautiously peered into the room. Empty, windowless, bare stone walls and floor. Leaving the door open, they proceeded to the next room. As the door burst open, an orange mass heaved in the torchlight, undulated toward them. Shut it, quick, said Zorath from the rear. Ochre jelly! They stumbled back from the doorway. A long pseudopod of glistening, translucent orange tissue thrust through the gap. The door was pulled shut. Olaf slashed at it with his sword. The thing fell to the gray flagstones with a plop. Immediately, it rolled into a ball and sent out a questing tendril towards Olaf's boot. Argh! Cried the warrior, jumping back out of reach, and slashing again. The blob of jelly was cut neatly into two creatures, each one of which humped up about 8 inches high. Burn it! Burn it! Shouted Bardan the dwarf. Olaf thrust his flaming torch into the closest of the motile globs. It sizzled and blackened, and tried to creep in the direction of the door. He pursued, jabbing it with the flames until it lay crisp and motionless. Watch out! The other one! Dancing on one foot, the besieged fighting man managed to kick the football-sized creature off his other boot and again apply the torch, leaving it fried and smoking. Ugh, filthy beast! After these encounters, the adventurers would have moved even more cautiously, had not the halfling's keen ears detected something approaching them down the corridor to the rear. They paused and listened. A harsh, grating, sliding sound was heard, as if someone were dragging a sack of heavy rocks down the tunnel. Down the side corridor, hissed Murray. I don't want to meet that, whatever it is. Hurrying now, not taking the time to test the safety of each flagstone, they made their way along one side corridor and then doubled back into another corridor, this one only 10 feet wide and as black as pitch. The torches were extinguished, and they waited in silence, broken only by their own breathing and the restless movements of the frightened mule. In the distance, the dragging noise grew closer and stopped. There's a narrow passageway here leading back toward the intersection, hissed Zerith. The halfling and I will slip back down there and see what it is. The halfling gulped audibly, but said nothing. A moment later, holding on to the elf's sword belt, with one hand for guidance, carrying his unsheathed short sword in the other, he found himself proceeding down the narrow passageway on tiptoe. Slowly and silently, they approached the intersection, visible by a faint glow of diffuse light from the shaft that pierced the roof just beyond. Peering around the armored hip of his companion, Boyger could see a great rounded form stretched the length of the corridor. Creeping to the entryway of their passage, the two gazed out on the monster, now occupied with the bodies of the dead orcs, which it was sweeping into its incredible maw and swallowing whole. The grisly business of swallowing the corpses was accomplished by a grinding, sloshing sound as the armored bodies were forced down its immense gullet. The halfling and the elf made a hasty retreat. "Purple worm," Zirup reported to the others in a whisper. "No sense in cowering here until he finds us. Let's keep moving. No lights. I will go first, since I can see in the dark, and Bardem will bring up the rear for the same reason. Single file, hold on to each other's belts. Murray, you lead the mule." And so on. Thank you.
So,
I'm sorry, I think we encountered the purple worm on our first adventure when we were first level. That was a shocker.
Which is neat, because Holmes included the purple worm in the basic rulebook, along with a lot of other very difficult monsters.
Yeah, you have to learn to run away. I believe that's one of the lessons of Dungeons & Dragons. No one to run, no one to hold.
Except each other. Getting through as a team.
Isn't it incredible the value of those sort of descriptions as well as those sample ones in the books, how important they were for us figuring out how to play the game?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, they're somewhat almost more important than the rules themselves to hear how people actually did things in a dungeon.
It's true, Jonathan.
It's great.
Yeah. So The Maze of Peril is Eric's novella, and it's about, if I remember, about 55,000 words or so. And it will be the sort of the center point around which the Tales of Peril collection that we're going to publish that pulls together all of the Boinger and Zareth fictions into one volume. It's around which that entire book is basically built. So the other stories that are the Boinger and Zareth set are listed out among Eric's other fictions as well in the handouts on page 2. So I went ahead and I took all this information from Zach's really wonderful essay and bibliography of Eric's works, which he has up on his blog.
Yeah.
And it's on originally from the Dragon's Foot threads where
that's
compiled.
Where I posted originally, yes.
Yeah. So these include, for the Boinger and Zareth stories, the Warrior for Hire and Alarms and Excursions, and then the Were-Shark story there as well, which are little episodes that sort of introduce some of the characters, and then in the case of Warrior for Hire, are sort of how to introduce henchmen and hirelings into your campaign. And then Eric wrote a series of stories there prior to the Dragon Magazine ones that recount adventures from the campaign with Chris. And you wrote some of these with him and illustrated them.
I didn't write anything.
Yet. Oh, I thought you wrote co-wrote some of them. Okay, all right.
No, he dashed those off, and I was like, oh, okay, let me draw something really quick.
I think there's an illustration of the were-shark with one of them, and
drawing were-sharks.
And the giant chameleon.
I can't stop.
From that story.
Yeah.
Partly because it's a way of dealing with the anxiety of having your character eaten when you're young and impressionable. And the more you draw your character being eaten, the more you can deal with that trauma and move on. I think I'm done drawing were-sharks now.
Were-shark.
So some of the other stories in Alarms and Excursions were The Adventure of the Giant Chameleon, The Adventure of the Lost City, Parts 1 and 2, and then Eric published The Maze of Peril in 1986 with Time Space, and then he started writing stories in Dragon Magazine. So Chris already referred to Troll's Head, which is the first one that appeared there back in 1979 in issue 31, and that was followed up by The Sorcerer's Jewel in issue 46. And that one had some really neat artwork by Jim Rosloff in there. And in that story, the characters meet a lich. and they're well, they're probably not first level by then. They're a little bit more capable in the fiction.
They have some magic to help them.
They do. And then the story I mentioned earlier that I had read first in Dragon 58 is in the bag. The book will also include an unpublished story called Witch Doctor. And then we have some nonfiction pieces in there. Chris will be writing an introduction for each of the stories, or he has written an introduction for each of the stories. And Zach has his long essay, and then the complete bibliography, which these really represent just a small portion of. We'll have that in there, and then I'll write an introduction for the book as well. So,
and the Psychology Today article.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, Confessions of a Dungeon Master, and that's actually like one of the first research activities I ever did for D&D. I went in when I was, because I had this librarian who knew about D&D when I was in school. I somehow found out about the story, probably from the Maze of Peril biography. And I went back and I tracked it down through the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature, of all things. Had to look up where it was. It's like, oh, and then I got a photocopy of it from interlibrary loan. So, yeah. So the beginnings of some research activity for me with that.
Because Dad was a neurology professor and in one of the, I guess, important people in Dungeons & Dragons on the West Coast, he got interviewed by the LA Times and... He wanted to write an article that would sort of make parents less nervous about their children playing this new weird game that seemed so obsessive and that was causing them anxiety. And I don't know how many parents read the article, but I encountered a college teacher later who had the article, and I bumped into a few people who read it, and it's a fun article. It's not very deeply, incisively, psychologically astounding. It's basically the same things that Tim Kask was telling people and Gary Gygax was saying. Your children are not going to go crazy, they're not going to go to hell, and they're not going to kill themselves, and they're, you know, chill out, you know. they're learning a lot of words, they're learning a little bit about math, and they're learning how to work together for a common goal, and they're socializing, so... God, Dungeons & Dragons is a wonderful game. And I'm not sure that my dad ever said that outright, but he certainly was one of the many defenders of it.
Yeah, so the introduction to the Confessions of a Dungeon Master article starts out, B.E. for law or B.E. for chaos, shouting the Dungeons & Dragons challenge. My players rush into the fray with their magic warhammers. Before getting an answer, their fantasy selves may indulge in murder, pillage, arson, rape. The Dungeon Master's world is a sort of a giant Rorschach test. So, can't go wrong with that.
It's not true, though. He never gave us a magic warhammer. He cannot be trusted.
So, some of the other things we were going to show you through the... through the slides included some of Chris's artwork in the original manuscript version sent to TSR for the basic set. We can't show you those right now, but we'll post those online and you'll be able to
download them. They're actually up on my
later.
Blog already if you want to take a look at them.
Yeah.
I think I posted them last week.
And then inside the handout, there's some other information. There's a map that's an early version of the Eye of Arras dungeon that Eric drew for the Fantasy Role-Playing Games book that he wrote in 1980, which is sort of a very high-level overview of the hobby, including miniatures and the fantasy fiction that sort of inspired the hobby, as well as a lot of the games that were published and available at that time. It's almost like an earlier version and more introductorily written way to approach fantasy role-playing games in general. Similar to Lawrence Schick's book, Heroic Worlds, published about 10 or so,
that was
15
one of
years
later. One of the first books about fantasy role-playing games that was ever published.
So there's a early version of the map in there, and then the handouts also include some of the characters from Chris's games with the family. So it's got a recreation of Boinger, and then there's actual scans of Murray's character sheet, and then Zaris is on the back, and they were just on little 8.5 or little 3x5 index cards.
Yeah, we love those cards for some reason.
So
you'll be shocked to see that the characters have an agility and a size, because we were playing introduced to the Caltech Warlock rules that included those characteristics. So. Dad eventually drew us into learning what you guys know as the basic set, and we rolled up first level characters and played some games of the of Holmes Basic, I guess. But I've probably played fewer games of Holmes Basic than anyone in this room. We played a sort of a bastardized version later because Advanced Dungeons & Dragons came out, and we liked a lot of the spells in it, and I liked druids, and I liked some other stuff in it. So I said, let's use these spells, but let's not use these, and let's do this. And Dad said yes to everything, so... he does mention his thoughts on Advanced Dungeons & Dragons and fantasy role-playing games, and he was very much a fan of it. But he didn't, for some reason, review Call of Cthulhu in fantasy role-playing games, but I know for a fact that he was a big fan of Call of Cthulhu as well. So Metamorphos Alpha and Call of Cthulhu and Dungeons & Dragons are our favorite games, and always will be, and they're the only games that he ran. He and I will also... lucky enough to see M.I.R. Barker run a game of Empire of Pale Throne and see the model that his players had made. And I ran one game of Empire of Pale Throne with my dad as a character. So we were definitely... we loved that game as well. He pretty much loved most of the games he encountered. Maybe not Tunnels and Trolls so much. But everything else, it's all great. Yes.
Did you actually use the spell points system that was from that game that your dad wanted to bring into Basic?
The Warlock. Yeah, we used spell points. I'm sorry, and we used a combat system that was very armor class sensitive or whatever. So we would obsess about which weapon to use against which armor class, which was a big waste of time. But the one thing I missed about the Warlock system when I had to play actual Dungeons & Dragons was I love the critical hits, and I like fumbles as well, but I think critical hits are a wonderful thing because they give you that sense that if you keep rolling, there's a chance you'll cut this dragon's head off or, you know, impale self. You know, you never know. It gives you that real excitement that you're going to get there or you're going to die horribly, but, you know, something good's going to happen or something really bad's going to happen. I love rolling those dice.
So it seems like a good time to open up this to questions from you guys. So if you have any questions for any of us or for each other, we'd be happy to help answer or sort through them.
We didn't get... the photos of my fellow players.
Oh, well, that's true.
Those. I think those were in the slides.
Those are in the slide.
Oh, yeah, the only ones we have are the ones on the cover.
You missed the mysterious girl player photo.
This is...
you're going to have to put those on the blog.
Yeah. This one appeared with the LA Times article in 1979. It's Holmes with a lot of his miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like an alternate version, I think, of the one that's in the fantasy role-playing book.
Yeah,
he got a...
You might be able to tell us something about that.
Well, the LA Times photographer famously took a picture of one of his medical students playing with him, whose name I don't know. And I was like, who's this guy? He's famous, and I'm not in this picture. And then there's just an early picture of Dad that looks pretty good. And then there's a picture of me playing my dad a Roman miniatures war game that he and I played on some terrain my brother and I made for him. I played the Picts. And my dad played the Romans, and he won. The Picts were slaughtered, and we had a great time. And my wife says that we should notice that there's empty bookshelves behind me, which she thinks is very strange.
There's a basic set on one of the shelves, though.
Yes, the basic set is there.
That photo was obviously stained.
Bookshelves. You're saying normally your dad had... Lots and lots.
Yeah,
of
my dad wasn't a carpenter, but he learned how to make bookshelves, and he made a lot. And there was...
he had boxes of comic books, right?
Three stories, yes. There were comic books, there were toys, there was paperback, science fiction hardcover, science fiction fantasy, pulp magazines, little big books, eventually Japanese anime toys, and detective fiction, some science books, not many. A lot of history books, a bunch of junk, yeah. bunch of loot.
Okay. Another thing that this these pictures show is his gaming table that he had, and this was in the basement of his house.
Yeah.
And it was painted with chalkboard paint.
Yeah.
And he would draw the dungeons in chalk.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
So he used miniatures in most games, right?
Yeah, he loved miniatures, and I think often he wasn't sure what the game was going to be until he bought the miniatures or the toys. Sometimes he'd bring rubber toys or plastic toys into the game too. And then I think the story started to develop as he painted the new monsters to show us.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter devoted to miniatures called Little Metal People in fantasy role-playing games. So he was definitely a fan.
And no Dungeon Master screen. We didn't know what that was until we went to Gen Con. And they were like, well, I don't know, that's weird.
Well, why don't you tell them about the model dungeon that you made that you brought to Gen Con?
Okay, I had a lot of excess energy, I guess, as a young man, and I said we should make a three-dimensional dungeon with real scaled rooms and decor and terrain and whatever, and then we'll put lids on top of each room and we'll make working doors. And he was like, "Yeah, let's do it." And so it was about a 6-foot by 4-foot wooden base he made for me with balsa wood walls, and then I took it home and I textured the balsa wood walls, sometimes with a little wooden gouge and sometimes with an X-Acto knife and sometimes by appliquing construction paper stone. I like did every different technique of making stonework and brickwork. I don't know who I was back then, but we made it, and then he said, well, let's take it to Gen Con. I'm like, well, don't you need to get permission, you know, to bring this big thing into their convention? He's like, no, we'll just set it up somewhere. And that's what we did. We just showed up at Gen Con. No one knew who we were, and we put up a sign on the wall that said, Beginners D&D, and people came by, and he ran a game where the little doors... You could move your figures to the little door and then listen at the door, and then when you got the nerve up, you could say, we go in, and then we would pull a little cardboard lid off and show them the room with a giant spider web or whatnot in it. And it was good fun. Good fun. And it still exists, but it's kind of filling up with bird seed and who knows what. Cobwebs. Rats.
More cobwebs, that's good.
There's a few pictures of it on my blog that Chris sent to me.
So do you guys have any questions or other stuff you'd like to talk about?
I'm curious, what's the timeline on the book?
So I was hoping to have the book here for the convention, but that didn't work out. But we should probably have it ready by the end of July, I think. We have a few things we're sorting out with the printer in terms of the print run size. But we just received the signature sheets for it. So we're going to do it as a signed and limited edition and the first print, and then it'll be a regular trade hardcover after that. And our intention is to experiment with getting it out on Amazon and such as well, since it's a regular book of fiction and whatnot, not just through regular gaming outlets.
Will we be able to pre-order?
If we get it up on Amazon, I would assume so, yes. If not, then you'll have to wait till we have it available. But yeah, we'll have some more information and be able to spread that through the forums as we get the final details of that nailed down. And certainly Zach will be able to, you know, share information on his blog or something like that too.
Sure. And it has some new drawings in it.
Cool. Yeah. So Chris wrote an introduction for each of the stories, and then he's got one illustration for each of the stories, I believe, as well.
Yeah, one new illustration.
Yeah.
Where Shark Chris?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I did a good Were-Shark this time. Yes.
I believe your dad wrote one article comparing his version of Basic D&D to the Molde version that came out afterward.
He wrote a review of the Molde.
Yeah.
Did he have a view of the Mensur version or any other versions that came out that were not published?
Not that I know of. I didn't actually know there were so many versions. I thought everyone was playing AD&D. And then I realized that there were all these really expensive Dungeons & Dragons books with color illustrations in them. And so I knew there was something else. But I really lost track of the history of basic D&D and so forth. I didn't know who Frank Mensur was last year. But his name rang a bell, And so I signed up for his game, and then it turned out that it was a great political move for me to go play with Frank Mentzer. and he, you know, he like had me sign his copy of Basic, which is sort of a silly thing to do, but I was very moved. And so, oh, you know, it's all good. It's all good stuff. And Dad's review of Mulvey Cook was very favorable, I thought. Yeah. Yeah. Good.
All right, well, if you guys don't have any other questions, thank you so much for coming, and have fun gaming the rest of the day.
I know you're all probably very smart, creative people, because you're here, and I have a sense for this. So I think one of the great things that Dad did was he did not give up his day job, but he did follow his dreams at the same time. And if he had quit teaching and tried to make his living as a writer, he probably would not have been as happy, and his family certainly would not have been as happy. So if some of you are teachers or whatever you do, do it, you know, do your job. And do it well, be good people, and try to be creative people too, but don't say, I want to be an artist or a writer or a game designer. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to give it all up and concentrate on my art. No, you can do both. Do both. You'll be all right. That's my lesson to young people. Here's one young person. Keep your day job. Thank you.
Thanks.
Graduations.